We all make mistakes as business owners. I've made my fair share. You've had more time to make your fair share.
A lot more.
So tell me, Paul, a little bit about, like, what are some of the biggest mistakes, you know, especially like mistakes that you've really learned a lot from? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you've made as a business owner, as an entrepreneur?
More than likely is not double checking, where you just believe you have everything done and boom, you file a return. And then you realize, oh, after it's been filed and after the client has received a love letter from the IRS in the state. That is probably one of the worst. And I've gotten two in my career that have been like hateful, where they got an attorney involved. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm not sure why you got them involved, but sure, let's go play ball. And it's always here. Let me just refund you back your preparation fee. The last time one was, it ended up where they did not get the Tabor refund, I believe, from 2 years ago. And I don't know how we got to small claims court, and then they won and made it my fault, and I ended up having to pay them for that Tabor refund, which should never have happened. I'm not even sure how.
That's crazy.
Yeah, the judge deemed it that they were owed it, and I thought, this makes zero sense. It's the taxpayer's responsibility, not mine, even though I'm supposed to be the one that's supposed to check for it, but it's their responsibility to go chase after it. So anyway, yeah, those were probably the two biggest mistakes ever.
I think that's a powerful lesson of, you know, my dad used to say, inspect what you expect.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have an expectation of something, but double check. And it's, you know, especially like when you're in the height of tax season and super busy, swamped with work, like those are the times when you're most likely to make those kinds of mistakes, you know. And I've had that too, you know, with appraisals. I've, you know, turned something in and realized, you know, after the fact, oh, I've made some mistake and now I have to like fix it. Or, you know, like I had one recently where the realtor put the when I opened up the purchase contract, it had counter offer, original purchase contract, and then other counter offer at the bottom.
What is an other counter offer?
So they had a couple back and forths in the negotiation, and it is typical to provide all of those, but it is not typical to put one counter and then the original offer and then the other counter at the bottom.
Right.
And so we missed the second counter. And so the second counter had a purchase price that was $15,000 higher than the original. And the counter offer that was at the very top of the document didn't have a purchase price on it. It was something else that changed, something minor. And so I get a call from the realtor a few days later saying like, hey, you know, she was nice, but she was like, hey, can you, you know, explain to me why this is low, you know, because like, you know, I thought that we were good. And I went and looked at it. And I'm like, no, like we came in above asking or above the contract price. I don't know what you're talking about. But lo and behold, like there was that other counter that we missed. And so then, you know, it's not like a huge deal because I can go back and say, hey, you know, when we did this report, it wasn't with all of the relevant information. The relevant information's changed or has been, you know, brought to our attention. And so we're reworking the opinion of value based on new information that was provided to us, which is like fully legitimate. But man, underwriters hate that. They hate that because they think, oh, you're just bringing it in at the sale price or whatever, which I really try not to do. You know, it's not like, okay, it sold at 520, the appraisal comes in at 520. Like that drives me crazy when appraisers do that.
Right.
But you know, that doesn't mean that the contract price is irrelevant. like it is relevant because like a market participant has decided that they're willing to pay X amount of dollars for this property.
Right.
You know, so that was one of my more recent mistakes, but I'm thinking more like big picture. So here on the Making Money podcast, we talk about not only the good things, but we talk about the things where we've messed up. And bigger picture, I would say one of the biggest, like, more like consistent mistakes that I've made is really like just analysis paralysis, like overthinking things and then like delaying the action. And so often the thing that we're afraid of is so much less scary than we think it is, but you don't realize how much less scary it is until you just do it. Just do the thing, like ask the girl, shoot your shot, run the ad, make the cold call, like whatever it is that's intimidating or scary. And I think for some people, there can be this idea that like, oh, if I think about it long enough, the fear will go away. But it doesn't work that way because your mind always generates more things that can go wrong or more like issues. And a lot of times it's just the biggest disarmor of fear is actually just doing something, you know, you just do it scared. And, so that's one of my sort of lessons that I've, you know, been slowly overcoming as time has gone on.
You know, the fear of making a mistake is a mistake all in itself.
I like that.
You know, we, it's just innate. We're just human. I mean, you know, the fear factor is, okay, I'm going to make a mistake, so let me just try to not do it. But by not doing it is the greatest mistake, if that makes any sense, of how we should work through that problem and how we should get to a resolution instead of, okay, I'm afraid to do this, so let me not step out of my comfort zone and let me just try to do it this way instead. And oftentimes, as someone in a profession that requires pretty much exact reality, not a fabricated reality, which is part of the fear factor, right? Because we fabricate these things in our head that we can't do this and we won't do this. And what if this happens? We're going to make this grave mistake. So we stay in this comfort zone. And this comfort zone oftentimes is a grave mistake. And a really good example is you get a project, and in my world, it's a tax project. So I have a client that gives me their returns, and it's much more complicated than I thought. So we just go through the easy route, and so we choose not to enter some of the important criteria, not thinking that that important criteria that's actually on this form needs to be there, or it'll generate a return that has an error in it. And a good example is if a person does not know who's preparing this return, rather, this person who's preparing it does not know where to place a dependent care credit that is on their W-2 from the client, showing that the employer has allowed this person to put X amount of money for a dependent care credit and did not put it onto the form 2441 on the person's tax return to allow them to either use the deduction or not qualify for the deduction. And by ignoring it, they're able to say, oh, well, I'm comfortable just not putting it there because I'm getting a green light and I can file. Okay, the mistake of doing that is this person could have qualified for a reduction of owing taxes or an increase in their refund because of that credit. But because you saw an error and didn't know how to fix it, and the client's in front of you and you didn't want to look stupid, your comfort zone is omit it so that they can still file the return.
Right. Now, kind of covering your ass.
It is. But the IRS isn't going to see this as an error or anything, because they're not going to see it, period, because it was omitted, and it doesn't affect anything positive or negative because it's a care credit that the employer allowed for them to put into their income for what they have, let's say $20,000 in income, and they allow them to take $5,000 of that and put it for dependent care credit. Well, it reduces their tax by $5,000, their income rather. And so that's great, but what if that person would have gotten some credit for that? What if they would have gotten a larger refund or owed less? But instead, we went the easy way out, which happens more often than not, because our comfort zone is, okay, well, I got a green light. I can transmit and file. I don't see any errors. Your client's not going to know the difference, yay or nay. They're trusting you as a professional to here, do this return, and here, file it for me, and here, give me my packet and let me know what the bottom line is. So then, and I have done that in the past in my early years of starting out, just because I didn't want to look stupid, or I was afraid of, here, if I do this, I'm going to make a mistake while the filing's occurring. Well, the graver mistake is not doing your homework and not telling your client I'm unsure, because your client is going to be more grateful in my eyes knowing that you have told them you're unsure and that you need to go and research this to make sure I get you the best return. That's my experience.
I think a lot of times, people are actually more inclined to trust you when you show a little bit of the human side. In a way, there can be kind of a fine line in there, but if you everyone knows that the tax code is extremely long and complicated, and I think most people would be reasonable and understanding of, like, hey, there's this, rule that I just got to look up and just double check and confirm something. I even have that, sometimes with appraising, with FHA rules. I mean, the FHA handbook is, I think, like 5,000 or 6,000 pages or something.
Oh,
like,
gosh.
It's freaking crazy. And so sometimes I have to look things up, and no one is like, well, you don't know all 5,000 pages. I'm like, no, nobody does.
No,
not even the people who wrote it, probably.
That's what I'm thinking. I was going to say the person who wrote it probably didn't even know.
Yeah. So, it's there can be there are certain situations where you do something like that, and then it's like, oh, this person is actually being really careful and methodical with what they're doing. And that can actually increase trust rather than someone who just acts like they know it all and have it all figured out already. And then, there's like less transparency in the process of the work that's being done.
I am the person who believes that if you don't know something, don't pretend to let the client know that you know everything, because a false pretense gives you a horrible result at the end of the day. I'd rather just literally tell my client, I don't have the answer and I need to look for it. And oftentimes I'll call the helpline for our software, just because new forms come out all the time. Like, literally there's a new form for this and a new form for that. And you as a professional can't possibly know every single form that's in there. I mean, there's just things that I've never used before, like a foreign tax credit for working out of the country. Once you exceed a certain dollar amount, you're going to have to pay taxes. But for the most part, people don't exceed that when they're working out of the country and they're U.S. citizen. And so once in a blue moon, I'll get someone that's in a foreign country who's a U.S. citizen and they've made X dollar and now we need to report this additional income. And I would go, I'm not too sure. I need to look into this, because those are things that do need a little more hand-holding. And especially for someone who isn't adept to doing something that has to do with foreign income. And a lot of times I will sit there and I'll call the help desk with the person there and get the answer that I need. Time is of the essence, right? And that's with everything we do. With somebody, we want it now, we want it delivered. We all want to be Amazon adept, or whatever that freight is going to be today. So never be afraid. I think the answer really here is we're going to make mistakes, but minimize those by doing your homework and also letting your client know you're not totally familiar with this. And, you know, I will do my best is the best answer instead of, oh, I got this.
I would say another one of the mistakes that I've made is waiting too long to mm-hmm. hire help.
Yes.
Because I was, you know, I had my reasons and my goals or whatever, but I really have been thinking a lot, like, especially recently, like just how much of a force multiplier, like help can be. Because you get to a point, well, I was actually thinking about this. So there's kind of this interesting cycle in entrepreneurship. It's like when you're an employee, you have a defined role in a company. And so you have like a specific set of responsibilities. Then when you venture out into entrepreneurship and starting your own business, now everything is your responsibility. Every role is your role. You're doing everything. And there you have a lot of control. You have all the control, essentially, because it's all on your shoulders. And that's like a completely different mindset. But then as the business grows, you almost have to shift back into creating roles and offsetting and delegating some of those roles and those tasks and responsibilities. And in doing so, giving up some of that power and control that you had in the early stages. But that's like a prerequisite for growth and a necessity for growth. And I think part of my own hesitation with hiring help came down to trust. I didn't trust other people to do the work at a high enough quality. And I'm thinking, you know, my reputation's on the line for my clients and this and that and the other. But ultimately, that is a limiting belief that hinders and puts a ceiling on growth, because then I, as the founder of the business, am spending all of my time just keeping the wheels turning, that I don't have actually any time to grow the business, to lay new foundations, to invest in whatever the next steps of growing the business may be. And so I would think that was a mistake that I made early on. Like, I should have hired sooner, even if it was part-time help, and gotten used to the idea of training employees and all of those, everything that involves and the processes. Because now that I have some help and I've taken some time to invest in an employee who I can offset certain or offload certain tasks to and trust that they'll be done like reasonably well, now I'm freed up to work on advertising and expanding the business. And I'm seeing the fruit of that, you know, very quickly. But I think that was something I waited too long to do and I should have done sooner.
I think that's a really good example. And once again, I go back to this fear factor. You know, yeah. We are afraid that if we let go of our control, because that's what it really is, if we let go of our control, then someone else may screw it up. Or the flip side, what if they do it better than I, and then they take my business? I've had that happen where an employee hired on thought that, oh, well, I know this way better than Paul, and I'll just start taking his clients, which they tried to do. You know, being a person that I hired thinking that, you know, this could be a protege, I thought this would be a great opportunity, you know, let them take the ball and run with it. And then I remember very distinctly, I was coming back from a trip and I get this phone call from my client saying that so-and-so called me and they're wanting to now be the person that's going to handle my account because you're no longer in business. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. So
that's news to you.
Absolutely. And of course my client knows me better than that. So yeah. I got back and I made some phone calls to some other clients that this person was working on, and sure as crap, same answer from everybody that I asked the question. And so I quickly ramified that one and let that person go. And all of a sudden, you know, I was getting slandered all over on the internet, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, you know, anyone who knows me is going to sit there and go, well, you know, that's all fabricated. So all the responses that were going back and bantering back and forth on this dialogue that was happening on my Facebook, you know, well, it's now all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, this person's really not who they said they were. And they were really trying to slander Paul. So sometimes letting go of that control and hiring somebody could be a downfall because we've hired the wrong person. And that's where I'm going with this. Be very careful when you're hiring staff and when you're hiring support staff and you're hiring a protege or anyone, actually, make sure you train them properly and you have a good sense about what's happening with the work that you're allowing them to do, which goes back to the fear factor and control factor. But to ride on what you had said about, you know, letting go and hiring somebody so it frees up time, which is very precious, I 100% agree with you there. I know that, you know, I've grown over the years from 10 clients to now I've had 750 plus active. And to be able to manage that amount requires staff. I definitely don't have the means to do it. No matter if I worked 20 out of the 24 hours, there's still not enough of me to do it. And quite frankly, I'm glad I have support staff.
Yeah, you don't want to work 20 hours a day. I don't. It's not sustainable. It's not fun. It's not worth it.
Absolutely not. And I like my long lunches.
Yeah,
I do. And I love to go out to eat. I love to have get-togethers at the house. So that requires some free time.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it's interesting the factor you're talking about of, like, you know, people swooping in and trying to take control. It made me think, it's like, I wonder if that's part of the reason why people are kind of drawn to these offshore workers, because they can't do that.
You get
more upside with less risk. You know, maybe there's different risk, whether it be language barrier or something else, or maybe sensitive data not being protected like it should be, or, you know, maybe it's not less risk. Maybe it's just different risk or not as easily perceived risk. But that was just kind of a thought that came to my head as you were talking about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it definitely can be, you know, it kind of taps into like one of the biggest fears that most appraisers have, and the reason why very few appraisers will train, you know, will take on a trainee that's not a relative, is the fear that I'm training my own competition, that I'm going to tell them about all my clients and all my secrets, and then they're going to open up their own appraisal practice down the road, and I'm going to be making less money competing against someone that I trained. And, you know, it's not an entirely unfounded fear, especially over the last couple of years where the market's been a lot slower and work is harder to come by for many appraisers. But it is, it's just one of those like human nature things, like self-preservation things, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, as I've been thinking about like, okay, how do I scale this business? Because, you know, it's, appraising is a licensed profession, just like being a CPA is a licensed profession, right? And so anytime you have, you know, if you're looking at a business model of like, okay, I want to create an appraisal business that does like $2 million a year in revenue or something, which is like thousands of appraisals, right? That means you're going to have multiple staff appraisers, which are people who could take your client base and leave, you know, and that's a risk that you have to take. So then you have to try and create incentives to make it better for them to stay with you, even though they're giving up part of the fee to do so. And it's a very interesting business model to try and tease out and to try and make work. And it's something I've done numerous times. And it's one that I don't know if it really works, because like theoretically, you could say, well, there's people out there who don't really want to work for themselves. And that's true. There are people out there who don't have the entrepreneurial aspirations. But are you going to hire only those people? Are you going to actually suss out like people who are going to actually be good but also not want to go out on their own? And like you're going to find that narrow slice of people every time? Like that's a pretty big gamble.
I would agree 100%. I mean, that's a risk, but you know, knowing who you hire and what their skill sets are very important. I think that's one of the mistakes we all often make, because we go and look at, when we're hiring, what's on paper first or on our computer screen these days. And then we automatically have this assessment in our head of what this candidate is like. And then they interview. And of course, anyone can talk a great talk. But oftentimes you can get a person that you're hiring that's a mole. And what that looks like is exactly what you're saying, is that, you know, they're coming to get your clients and then start something on their own. And I don't think, as a person who is an entrepreneur myself, I don't think that the people who do that really think it through, because you hear oftentimes, or at least I do, well, I can do this better than them. I should just start my own business and do this. And oftentimes people try to do it and they fall flat on their face. I mean, it's not an easy thing to start a business. And that's why one of the things we talk about in this podcast as tonight is the mistakes. And sometimes I hear that, you know, these people have started their own businesses, and rightfully so, they come to me. Here, let me get you started in this business. And then I find out that they've gotten this idea from somebody else. And the next thing I know is, oh, well, shoot, they're suing me because I took their client database. And that has happened before. I've seen that happen. And that's not a pretty situation to be in. You know, no matter what those dollars look like, don't chase the money. That's another thing. Don't chase the money, especially if you're trying to start a business. Don't try to knock your competition down. Your competition is your friend. Think about that one for a second. Why would your competition be your friend? Because they have had the experience that we've talked about. They have done it in some shape, fashion, some manner that has afforded them to become profitable in that arena.
You can learn a lot from competition, especially those who have been in that space, you know, if longer than you have, or as long as you have, if you've been there for a long time. And there's, like you said, they've made the mistakes already, and you could potentially learn from them. You could watch and model, like, oh, they're trying this advertising approach, or they're offering this product and service combo, or they're doing this offer, this sale. You know, there's so many different things that you can learn and glean from watching and paying attention to others, rather than just ignoring them or just being bitter that they exist, that the fact that you have competition, right? But one of my favorite things about entrepreneurship really has been that, you know, you make these mistakes and you learn, and it's not just, oh, I learned this thing on a piece of paper that, you know, makes my business better, but you actually like have so many opportunities to grow as a person. You know, and that growth as an individual, the character, the strength, the perseverance, the toughness of mind is something that I've come to really, really value. And it's something that I really love about entrepreneurship. Like, it stretches and grows me and makes me uncomfortable and pushes me out of my shell so much. I mean, even, you know, going to these meetup events and networking with other entrepreneurs, I don't want to go most of the time. It's not because I'm shy. I'm not shy. I just don't care. Sometimes I'm at the end of a long working day, and like the last thing I want to do is drive a half an hour downtown to go into a loud bar and try and like shout over people to talk to other people. You know, it does not sound like a good time to me. But then I go, and then it ends up being good, and I go, yeah, that was worth it. But it's like work, it's effort, it's out of my, it's not what I want to do. But it's like, but I have these goals, these things that I want to achieve, and I know that if I'm going to achieve them, I have to do X, Y, and Z. And I don't want to do X, Y, or Z, but I have to do all three of them. And that process of like being forced to push myself in those ways is, I think, part of what, in a way, like, it's just not just about like growth, but I think actually part of what makes life meaningful. And I think part of what it just, this is just my own personal opinion perspective, and you can tell me what you think about this, but I think a lot of like 9-to-5 kind of work has this reputation of being kind of lifeless and dull and like extremely routine, because it can be. But I think part of it is because most jobs don't really push us to grow as people. And without having something difficult to work on and push us to grow, I think we just start to feel very dead on the inside. Maybe not everyone, but I think many people feel that way. And so, you know, this where entrepreneurship kind of forces that upon you. But if you work a 9-to-5, you can do that to yourself, whether it be through fitness, physical exercise, or some other difficult thing. But I've really come to like the belief that like we human beings are put on this earth to do hard things, and that doing hard things is actually like really, really good for us. But that needs to be voluntarily chosen, right? Because if it's just if it's just like tyrannically thrown upon you, like then you're just suffering, right? But and you know, sometimes life demands things of us because we have like a relative that gets sick, or we personally get injured, or whatever, you know, life happens, right? But I do think like as much as we as human beings are like inclined to run from pain and seek out pleasure, it actually is like willingness to embrace the hard things and the pain and the growth that comes from that is a big part of what makes life meaningful, I think.
I feel that, you know, as human beings, as you're saying, we're all here for an experience. So it doesn't matter what belief you are. Everything you do is an experience. So those experiences are your lessons that you're going to take with you to either teach somebody or not. And there's only two options there, right? And I like to teach. I'm a teacher. And I love to empower people, and I love to give everybody the opportunity to learn. But a lot of times we as humans are, we're just here to get through a day. And as you were saying, you're 9-to-5. It's a prime example. Some people are just complacent. I don't know any other word I can use, but they're just complacent. They're just happy that, you know, I'm just getting by my day. I know what my paycheck's going to be, and A, B, and C goes with that. I can pay my bills. I can get food. I can do this and this. Whereas the other side, as being an entrepreneur, you can dictate and command at some point what your income's going to be. You know, I always looked at it as, okay, well, you know, I got freedom, I have no boss, I can do what I want, and I'm happy. And once you get to that point of happy, is it really happy? I don't know. That's a question that I have to pose to myself. Am I really happy? And sometimes I think not. Just because I own my own business or businesses and I have all this freedom, does that really make me happy? I don't know. I enjoy thoroughly everything I do. I'm very passionate about everything I do. But does that make me happy? Passion does not necessarily make you happy. Passion is just meaning that it gives you a drive. And,
yeah.
And that drive is to continue on. And that answer to continue on to what, that is my question of the day. I actually don't have an answer for myself. I'm addicted to starting new businesses.
Yes, you are.
I am truly
addicted. And buying new businesses.
And buying new businesses.
Yeah.
Am I addicted?
You're collecting them like they're Nike Jordans.
They are, absolutely. I think I'm addicted, and 100% fitting that word and that description. So does it make me happy? To a degree, yes, but I think I do it out of comfort, A, because I know what I'm doing when I buy a business, and not to just pat myself on the back. I really do know what I'm doing. And it's not about trying to be one up on somebody, where a lot of times people would think that, but it's really not. It's about, I enjoy trying something new and empowering myself to get to that next level of entrepreneurship. business ownership, running multiple businesses, being able to delegate. I think there's a certain point where being an entrepreneur is more than just being self-employed.
It can be basically just like a high-paying job.
It could.
You know, when you have like a very small business, especially if you're a solopreneur. And, you know, the topic of happiness, maybe that's for another night. But it's my hot take on that is that the pursuit of happiness is overrated and that the pursuit of meaning is superior.
I 100% agreed. I couldn't say it any better than that, Ben. Absolutely. And mistakes, as where our topic is tonight, we all make mistakes. And sometimes they're repetitious. And that means we haven't learned the right way of doing something. So insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. And that's because we're complacent. And complacency is a mistake.
It is a mistake. But, you know, despite all the many, many mistakes that we have made in life and business over the years, we're still here. And I think that's the takeaway is, you know, there's almost like a weird thing where like the more mistakes you make and then you realize, oh, wait, I'm still alive. I'm still here. I'm not sleeping under a bridge or whatever. Or maybe you did sleep under a bridge for a while, but then you came out of it. And like it's almost like the more and more hard shit that you go through and overcome, the more confident you get because it's like, well, if I did it once, I could do it again. And it really disarms the fear around making mistakes and around taking risks. It's like the more that I do it and then overcome whatever the fallout may be if I mess up, then the more confident I am that I can recover from whatever the next mess up may be.
Absolutely.
And I think that's really the perspective. That is the perspective of the veteran. The veteran entrepreneur is the recognition that, you know, and I've heard it said by so many different entrepreneurs and business owners that they said, the reason that I win and I beat most people is because I take action faster and make my mistakes sooner than everyone else. And then by the time they've started, I've already made 30 mistakes and learned 30 lessons and figured it out.
Absolutely agreed. 100%.
And so that's why we want to talk about some of our mistakes and failures tonight and do a little bit of a slightly different format, a little bit more conversational, but that's Paul Ng. I'm Benjamin Foss, and it's been a good chat tonight.
It has. Thank you, Ben.
I appreciate it. It's good. So let us know what you think about this little bit of a different format, if you like the little bit more conversational, less structured nature, and we will see you in the next one.